Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
By bankrolling the expansion of oil and gas, the top banks of the world have blood on their hands, says Jake Johnson, writer, in an article published under the heading, 60 largest banks have dumped $3.8 trillion into fossil fuels since 2015, report shows. Stay tuned, please, for the details. A detailed new report released recently by a coalition of environmental groups shows that the 60 largest banks in the world have poured more than $3.8 trillion in the fossil fuel industry since the Paris Climate Accord was adopted in 2015, providing key financing for destructive projects ranging from coal-fueled power plants in Indonesia to Enbridge Line 3 tar sands pipeline. Many of the world's largest banks, including all six major U.S. banks, have made splashy commitments in recent months to zero out the climate impact of their financing over the next 30 years. But what matters most is what they are doing now, and the numbers don't lie. Ben Cushing, financial advocacy campaign manager with Sierra Club, said in a statement recently. The 80-page Banking on Climate report shows that J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo have provided more money for fossil fuel industry than any other banks in the world, at a time when scientists are warning that fossil fuel extraction and use must be rapidly curtailed in order to avert environmental catastrophe. Between 2016 and 2020, the new report notes, Chase's lending and underwriting activities have pumped nearly $317 billion into fossil fuels, funding that cast serious doubt on the massive bank's promise last October to align its financing commitments with the Paris Agreement's climate targets. We must understand that by bankrolling the expansion of oil and gas, the top banks of the world have blood on their hands, and no amount of greenwashing, carbon markets, unproven techno fixes, or net zero commitments can absolve their crimes against humanity and Mother Earth, said Tom Goldtooth, executive director of Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN. Indigenous lands globally are being plundered. Our inherent rights are being violated, and the value of our lives have been diminished to nothing in the face of fossil fuel expansion, Goldtooth added. For the sacredness and the territorial integrity of Mother Earth, these banks must be held accountable for covering the cost of their destruction. In 2020 alone, amid a global pandemic, the world's 60 largest banks increased by over 10% their financing for the 100 companies most responsible for fossil fuel expansion around the world, including BP, Shell, ConocoPhillips, Equinor, and Enbridge, according to the new report. Assembled by the Rainforest Action Network, Oil Change International, IEN, and other advocacy groups, the report argues that banks must take a number of concrete steps in order to truly bring their practices into line with what the science says is necessary to ensure a livable and sustainable future. Prohibit all financing for all fossil fuel expansion projects and for all companies expanding fossil fuel extraction and infrastructure along the whole value chain. Commit to phase out all financing for fossil fuel extraction, combustion, and infrastructure on an explicit timeline that is aligned with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, starting with coal, aiming, mining, and coal power, as well as financing for existing projects and companies active in tar sands oil, Arctic oil and gas, offshore oil and gas, fracked oil and gas, and LNG. As part of this commitment, require fossil fuel clients to publish plans to phase out fossil fuel activity on a 105 degrees Celsius aligned timeline. Commit to measure, disclose, and set targets to zero out the absolute climate impact of their overall financing activities on a 1.5 degrees Celsius aligned timeline, including short, medium, and long-term targets, and fully respect all human rights, particularly the rights of indigenous peoples, including their rights to their water and lands, and the right to free, prior, and informed consent as articulated in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Prohibit all financing for projects and companies that abuse human rights, including indigenous rights. This report serves as a reality check for banks that think that vague net zero goals are enough to stop the climate crisis, said Lorne Stockman, senior research analyst at Oil Change International. Our future goes where the money flows, and in 2020 these banks have plowed billions into locking us into further climate chaos. Banks need to be focused on reducing fossil fuel production now, rather than on a far-off an insufficient goal in the distant future. The time for half measures is over, Stockman added.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, praised cleverness. He regarded it as the only source of man's happiness and righteousness. He, peace be upon him, said, "The goodness of all coexistence and living together is a full measure. Two-thirds of the measure are cleverness, and one-third of it is heedlessness. Nothing has a portion of good and righteousness except cleverness. That is because man feigns inattention to the things which he realizes and knows." How wonderful this maxim is. A religious scholar commented on it, saying, "Indeed, it has gathered together all the righteousness of the affairs of the world."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam has many beautiful conversations between him and his companions, his friends, and his followers. These conversations are chock full of beautiful words of wisdom and knowledge. Truly, Imam al-Baqir was known as Baqir al-Ulum, meaning the one who splits open the sciences and knowledge. We find in one such conversation, in one such golden dialogue, that Imam al-Baqir was talking with one of his companions. In this conversation with his companion, Of course, Imam al-Baqir was talking about how to treat people in the society according to the rules of social conduct, which are delineated in Islam. Now, these rules of social conduct, these manners of social etiquettes, are delineated in Islam, but what must be kept in mind is that in reality the source of these rules and these manners and this method of perfecting humanity is from Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And so Imam al-Baqir was talking to his companions in this conversation, and he talks about specifically the rights which Islam has legislated for the Muslims towards his Muslim brother and sister. In response to this question about how one should treat their Muslim brother and sister, Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, replies, "Love your Muslim brother. Love for him what you love for yourself, and hate for him what you hate for yourself." It's very beautiful and it's very interesting, and it's indeed quite interesting. If a lot of the religions of the world, if a lot of the people of the world actually bothered to listen to the words of the Ahl al-Bayt, the family of the Holy Prophet, the divinely appointed Imams from the Holy Prophet, if they had bothered to listen to them and read their words, truly they would find that Islam is a most all-encompassing, complete, and perfect religion. Here we find that the fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, speaks with his companions in this dialogue, and he talks about how one should love their Muslim brother. And how do you gauge your love for your Muslim brother? Well, you love for them what you love for yourself. And likewise, how do you gauge what you should hate for your brother? Well, you hate for them what you would hate for yourself. So you would love to pray on time, help your brother to pray on time, while you yourself also pray on time. You would hate to be poor, well, help your brother to not be poor. Or you would hate somebody to backbite you, do not backbite your brother. Allahu Akbar, very beautiful, profound, and encouraging as well as inspiring words found in this short but profound dialogue of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One or two, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the Imam, is the issue of, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zainul Abideen. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, people had been brainwashed against the Ahl al-Bayt. This individual was from Ahl al-Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahl al-Kitab from the Arab community. And he says, "Anta ibn al-Sawda al-Zanjiyya al-Bawiyya, na'uzu billah." And this was not even true. He says, "You are a son of a Zanji, Zanjis, Moors, Zanjibari, African, from an African lady, a black lady. And remember, who is the mother of our fifth Imam? Among all the Imams, he is known as Alaviyun Bain al-Alaviyin. He is the only pure Alavi among the Imams. Because all others, their mothers are from other families. You know, his father is Imam Zainul Abidin, and his mother is Fatima bint Hassan. So they are cousins. Son of Imam Hussein, daughter of Imam Hassan. These are the parents of our fifth Imam. So there's no issue of using this kind of language for her at all. But even then, lam yaghdhab al-imam, Imam did not become angry. Because he realized that this person has been brainwashed. It's not that his evilness is, you know, from his nature. No, he has been told wrong things about me and about Ahlul Bayt. And so Imam then says, well, whatever you are saying about my mother, if it be true, may Allah forgive her. Because the last term, al-Badiyya, was not a good term. And if you are wrong in what you are saying, may Allah forgive you. And that is where this person realized, you know, I'm trying again and again to insult him, to provoke him, to make him angry, but he is responding at all these situations, you know, with politeness. And this was actually the basis of this person who came with this wrong impression of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir as the descendant of Ali, the way they have been told about Ali and Ali Ali. This politeness and akhlaq of our fifth Imam changed a Ahle Kitab enemy into a Muslim and a Shia of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wassalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
The planet could have a year or less before first generation COVID-19 vaccines are ineffective and modified formulations are needed, according to a survey of epidemiologists, virologists, and infectious disease specialists. Scientists have long stressed that a global vaccination effort is needed to satisfactorily neutralize the threat of COVID-19. That is due to the threat of variations of the virus, some more transmissible, deadly, and less susceptible to vaccines that are emerging and percolating. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Natalie Grover. The piece is titled, New COVID Vaccines Needed Globally Within a Year, Say Scientists. Stay with us for more of Natalie Grover's article. Planet could have a year or less before first-generation COVID-19 vaccines are ineffective and modified formulations are needed, according to a survey of epidemiologists, virologists, and infectious disease experts. Scientists have long stressed that a global vaccination effort is needed to satisfactorily neutralize the threat of COVID-19. This is due to the threat of variations of the virus, mutations in the virus, some more transmissible, deadly, and less susceptible to vaccines that are emerging and percolating. The grim forecast of a year or less comes from 2/3 of respondents, according to the People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition of organizations including Amnesty International, Oxfam, and UNAIDS, who carried out the survey of 77 scientists from 28 countries. Nearly 1/3 of the respondents indicated that the time frame was likely of just 9 months or less. Persistent low vaccine coverage in many countries would make it more likely for vaccine-resistant mutations to appear, according to 88% of the respondents who took part in the survey. Those who work across illustrious institutions such as Johns Hopkins, Yale University, Imperial College London, London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and so on. New mutations arise every day. Sometimes they find a niche that makes them more fit than their predecessors. These lucky variants could transmit more efficiently and potentially evade immune response to previous strains of the virus, according to Greg Gonsalves, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Yale University, in a statement. Unless we vaccinate the world, we leave the playing field open to more and more mutations, which could churn out variants that could evade our current vaccines and require booster shots to deal with them. The current crop of vaccines that have received emergency authorizations in different parts of the world is a mix of old and fresh technologies. One such technology is mRNA approach employed by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, which can be tweaked at speed within weeks or months to accommodate new variants of the virus. However, manufacturing hiccups are always a potential problem. But crucially, they are unlikely within reach of poorer countries, given that this set of vaccines are far more expensive and have comparatively onerous temperature storage requirements. Meanwhile, some rich countries have administered at least one dose of vaccine to more than a quarter of their populations and have secured hundreds of millions of vaccine supplies. In contrast, nations such as South Africa and Thailand haven't even managed to get shots in the arm of 1% of their populations. Some countries are yet to administer their first dose of the vaccine. COVAX, the Global Vaccine Initiative Coalition, aimed at countering so-called vaccine nationalism, hopes to be able to supply at least 27% of the population of lower-income countries with vaccines in 2021. The urgency we see in rich nations to vaccinate their populations, aiming for all adults by the summer, is simply not reflected globally. Instead, we have COVAX aiming for perhaps 27% by the end of the year, if we possibly can manage it. That is simply not good enough, said Max Lawson, head of inequality policy at Oxfam, a charity and a non-governmental organization, and the chair of the People's Vaccine Alliance, which is calling COVID-19 vaccine developers to openly share their technology and intellectual property rights to boost production. Where is the ambitious global goal? A goal that the science tells us is needed. I think that's the key point, said Max Lawson. We just don't see the ambition that would go along with it, widespread recognition that limited vaccination is quite dangerous. The normal rules of business that protect the profits of vaccine manufacturers will have to be set aside if that is what it takes to ensure everybody is immunized against the coronavirus, according to the Director General of the World Health Organization, WHO. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, says the world needs to be on a war footing. Before a key meeting of the World Trade Organization on the anniversary of the declaration of the pandemic, he supported a patent waiver that would allow countries to make and sell cheap copies of anti-coronavirus vaccines that were invented elsewhere. The director of WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said, "We're living through an exceptional moment in history and must rise to the challenge." He said, "Flexibilities in trade regulations exist for emergencies, and surely a global pandemic which has forced many societies to shut down and caused so much harm to business, both large and small, qualifies as such an emergency. We need to be on a war footing, and it's important to be clear about what is needed."
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, not committing a sin. A sincere Muslim gives primary attention to doing good deeds. As we know, even the best of us may sometimes fail to reject a tempting poor choice. Instead, a blameworthy deed is about to be committed. If a person ends up not committing the intended sin after having determined to do al-adlm, which is, you know, strong determination, he or she falls into one of the following categories regarding that intended action. Number one, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of Allah, that is, for the sake of pleasing Allah and intending to conform to what Allah requires. In such case, this person is awarded and rewarded for changing his mind and, in the end, determining not to do that bad deed. Number two, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of people. Now, in this case, it's not Allah, it is the fear of people. In such a case, this person has, even so, still committed a sin, a blameworthy act of heart, while leaving off the action of the intended sin is a rewardable act of worship. Still, it is rewardable only when done for the sake of pleasing Allah, not for the sake of looking good in the eyes of people around him. Whatever and whether they be fellow Muslims or non-Muslims.
So see how these two scenarios, the only thing that changed was in one case, the person did not commit a sin for the sake of Allah. In the other case, he did not commit a sin for the sake of people. And the end result is entirely different. We're going to go over three more scenarios with you after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. We discussed two scenarios of not committing a sin before the break, and now let's talk about the third one. A person who has determined to commit the bad deed but fails because he's not actually capable of carrying it out. He may be prevented by circumstances beyond his control. In this category, he doesn't seek the means to overcome those circumstances. Perhaps he simply loses interests for the time being. In such a case, this person is accounted as having committed a bad deed due to his having determined to follow through on something he had weighed in his heart and decided to go ahead. Now, number four, a person who fails to commit the bad deed because he's incapable of doing so. In this category, unlike the previous one, he seeks, but unsuccessfully, the means of committing it. In such a case, a full bad deed is written to the account of this person because having the will to commit a sin is like committing it. In this case, he did not change his mind about trying to follow through the first category, nor did he stop seeking the means to fulfill his intention. Last but not the least is a person has a continuing intention and determination to perform a blameworthy deed. That person is punishable for it. Whether his continuing intention came before his first success at the bad deed or again after the further successful repetition of this bad deed. So if a person commits a sin and then he intends to do it again when he again has the opportunity, this is a person who insists on committing sins. In that case, he is punishable for this intention even if he never actually succeeds again in committing the sin. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron discuss Russia's Sputnik V vaccine and its use in Europe on a conference call on Tuesday, 30th of March, according to the Kremlin. Moscow's statement said that, among other subjects, the Russian, German, and French leaders discussed prospects for the registration of the vaccine in the European Union and the possibility of shipments and joint production of Sputnik V in EU nations. It did not say who raised the topic. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley. The piece is titled Merkel, Macron and Putin in Talks About Using Sputnik V Jab in Europe. Stay with us for more of the article by John Henley. Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron discussed Russia's Sputnik V vaccine and its use in Europe on a conference call on Tuesday, 30th of March, according to the Kremlin. Moscow's statement said that, among other subjects, the Russian, German and French leaders discussed prospects for the registration of the Sputnik vaccine in the European Union and the possibility of shipments and joint production in European Union nations. The statement did not say who raised the topic. The European Union's sluggish vaccine rollout has been dogged by an early shortage of doses, but those shortfalls were expected to ease significantly from the beginning of next month, with more than 300 million doses of Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines set to arrive in April, May and June. The German government confirmed last week it would be open to using the Sputnik vaccine if and when it is approved by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, with Angela Merkel's spokesman, Stefan Siebert, saying an eventual green light from the European Medicines Agency, EMA, would make the shot worth considering for Germany. Referring to the Russian vaccine, the Chancellor herself said Germany should use any vaccine that has been approved by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, while the German Health Ministry said last week all vaccines are welcome if they have been approved by the EMA. France has been considerably more circumspect, however, with French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian last week accusing both Russia and China of using their vaccines to gain influence and score points abroad. Jean-Yves Le Drian told France Info Radio, "In terms of how it is managed, the Sputnik vaccine is more of a means of propaganda and aggressive diplomacy than a means of solidarity and health aid." Thierry Breton, the French European Union Commissioner who heads the EU Executive's Vaccine Task Force, has also said the European bloc has absolutely no need for Sputnik V vaccine, since it clearly has the capacity to deliver 300 to 350 million doses by the end of June. The Sputnik vaccine manufacturer responded aggressively, saying in a series of Twitter posts that Thierry Breton was clearly biased and demanding, "If this is an official position of the European Union, please inform us that there is no reason to pursue EMA approval because of your political biases." The European regulator EMA launched a rolling review of Sputnik V vaccine earlier this month, a step towards it being approved as the first non-Western coronavirus jab to be used across the bloc. European Union experts are due to visit Russia in April to check the results of clinical trials and inspect the production process. Russia registered the shot in August before large-scale clinical trials, prompting initial fears about the safety of Sputnik V, but reviews since then have been largely positive, with The Lancet publishing results showing the vaccine is safe and more than 90% effective. Russian manufacturers have not so far managed to increase domestic production to meet demand at home and abroad. But the Russian government has said the country aims to produce 178 million individual doses of Sputnik V vaccine and two other vaccines, the Epivac Corona and the Covivac, by the end of June. It has also said it hopes to fully vaccinate 30 million Russians by the same date, leaving a possible 118 million domestically produced vaccine shots available for export. It also has reportedly set up production deals with 10 other countries to produce its vaccines outside of Russia. Russian pharmaceuticals company R-Pharm said last week it expected to begin joint production of Sputnik V vaccine in its plant in Bavaria in southern Germany, with doses starting to become available from June. France and Spain have also been named as potential production sites for Sputnik V production within the European Union. The three leaders, Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Emmanuel Macron, also discussed the conflicts in eastern Ukraine, Libya, and Syria, according to the Kremlin statement. The statement said Putin also responded to questions about the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny during a frank and businesslike discussion. Meanwhile, Russia's Sputnik V vaccine appears to be gaining acceptance in European Union, as the head of Germany's regulatory authority publicly praised the COVID-19 jab, and Italy could become the first European country to produce the Sputnik V vaccine from the summer. Thomas Mertens, the head of Germany's Standing Commission on Vaccination, described Sputnik V in an interview as a good vaccine that will presumably also be approved in the European Union at some point. Russian scientists are very experienced in vaccines, Thomas Mertens told Rheinische Post. Sputnik V is a very clever construct, he said. Russia drew criticism last summer when it approved Sputnik V for widespread use after less than 2 months of human testing, amid fears that Kremlin was hoping to leverage the vaccine as a soft power tool. But large-scale clinical trials, results published in The Lancet in February of this year, deemed the vaccine to be safe and offers about 92% protection against COVID-19. The Russian Sputnik V jab is being assessed by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, but has already been ordered to put to use in some European Union countries, particularly in Eastern Europe. From July, the Russian vaccine could also be produced inside the European Union after a deal was struck between Adyen, an Italian-Swiss pharmaceutical company, and the Russian Direct Investment Fund. Depending on approval from Italian regulators, production could begin at the company's factory in Caponago near Milan in July, with 10 million Sputnik doses expected to be produced for export to non-EU countries by the end of the year. Vincenzo Trani, the president of the Italian-Russian Chamber of Commerce, which helped bring the deal together, hailed the move as historic and said it would help create jobs in Italy. Trani added that agreement reflected the healthy state of relations between our two countries and underscores how Italian companies can see beyond political differences. The Italian government was reportedly not made aware of the deal, although the Ministry of Economic Development said it was a legitimate operation. Attilio Fontana, the president of the Lombardy region in Italy, said the agreement was good news. Sputnik will not be made available for use in Italy unless it is given approval by both the European Medicines Agency, EMA, and the Italian Pharmaceutical Authority, AIFA. Leading politicians, as well as several medical experts, have called for Sputnik to be approved for use in Italy. where the vaccination program has been hampered by late deliveries of other vaccines. Roberto Speranza, the Italian health minister, said if Sputnik got approval, then it would be used in Italy. If a vaccine works and if EMA and IFA say that it is safe and effective, then nationality doesn't interest me, he added. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, which has so far authorized the use of BioNTech, Pfizer, Moderna and AstraZeneca vaccines, began assessing the Russian Sputnik V vaccine on 4th of March this year.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The last century began with an English coup d'etat, while this century begins with elections and government on the basis of the people's votes.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. Once again, I wish to congratulate all the dear people of Iran, and I ask Allah the Exalted to bestow a blessed and auspicious year on all of them. We have entered into the year 1400. According to the common viewpoint, this year is the year of entrance into a new century. Although it may not be correct technically speaking, people say that we have entered into a new century. If we want to make a small but significant comparison with the country's entrance into the previous century, the year 1300, the latter was the beginning of the Reza Khan's dictatorial and dependent regime.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
It was in fact an English coup launched by Reza Khan, and that regime was in fact a dependent, tyrannical and English regime. That was how the country entered into 1300. This year, the year 1400, is the year of elections, which means government on the basis of independence, the people's vote and national self-confidence. So our entrance into this century has such an important difference with the entrance into the year 1300, the 14th century. I hope that God will drive all our affairs forward with the same proportion. I have prepared certain issues to discuss. The first is about this year's slogan, which stresses production once more but with a focus on the support that should be provided for it and the obstacles that should be eliminated. Later, I will discuss the issue of the upcoming elections. And I will raise a few points about it. And finally, I'll raise a few short points about foreign events, the issues of the day, and also the Barjam, JCPOA with the dear Iranian nation.
Around the World with Reporters.
Another weekend of protests in the UK, the southwestern city of Bristol, the front line of the battle against the British government's new policing bill that places new limits on protests. Demonstrators could face new fines of up to 10 years in prison for damaging a statue or memorial. The peaceful demonstration descended into violence at some point. Police were pelted, protesters pepper sprayed, and charged at with dogs. 10 were arrested. Thousands took to the streets across Britain. In Manchester, they blocked the tram lines. They were forcefully removed. 18 of them arrested. The UK police crackdown on protests since the murder of a young woman, allegedly at the hands of a police officer, has been under scrutiny. Critics have accused them of using deliberate and orchestrated tactics against the protesters. Last week, police retracted their claims that some officers suffered serious injuries during attempts to disperse a similar protest last weekend. But the government has remained uncompromising. Since the violent clashes in Bristol, it's condemned the protesters. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called the clashes disgraceful, and his Home Secretary Priti Patel described the protesters as thugs, intent on causing trouble.
The contentious bill is still being debated in the UK Parliament. Critics say it gives draconian powers to the police, curtails freedoms, and does too little to protect women and girls. So far, the government has shown no sign of changing course, and those protesting against the bill say neither are they. Saeed Puriza, London.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave.
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yusuf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yusuf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison.